Good afternoon, everyone. It's my very great pleasure to welcome you all to this afternoon's Festival of Ideas session, which is the second in a three-part discussion of the genetic revolution. And before I go on, I just want to mention, if I could ask you please to put your phones to silent. You don't need to switch them off. If you want to go tweeting, please tweet away. But if you could put them on silent, we would appreciate it. So as I said, this is the second of three sessions on the topic of the genetic revolution. And this morning's session on health and human identity was a wonderful introduction to the genetic revolution and how it's impacting on human health and individual identity. In this session, we consider the impact of the genetic revolution on our need for food and power, or energy as it's referred to in the public domain. But before we launch into these issues, I'd like to raise the question of what the topic of food, power, and the genetic revolution has to do with identity. While we tend to think of technologies as somehow separate from identity, in fact, genetics has had a profound effect on us, particularly in terms of the Australian farming heritage and love of the bush. Traditional breeding techniques, for example, in the development of the Merino ram and in the pioneering plant breeding carried out most notably by William Farrer, these developments made an indelible mark on post-European settlement in Australia and created one of the great identities of the nation, that of the Australian farmer and through rural settlements an attachment to and love of the Australian bush. So how does this new genetic revolution impact on this identity? I argue here that both sides of the deep division in our attitudes to genetically modified crops, for example, can be seen to be supported by different aspects of that great rural tradition. On one side, we have our love of the bush, which in some ways underpins our opposition to GM crops through the perception that genetic modification may threaten natural species and ecosystems. In addition, I feel that there's another strand of our historical identity that underpins the opposition to genetically modified crops. Because of my parents' farming background, I understand the fierce independence and self-reliance that my farmer forebears possessed as they settled and began farming some pretty forbidding landscapes on this continent. The development of engineered high-tech strains of plants and animals could, arguably, increase the power of multinational corporations and thereby threaten to override the independence of farmers and place them under work conditions dictated by large companies. I might add that such pressures exist independent of any GM technological advances. We recently saw, for example, the potato farmers fighting McCain's over conditions being imposed on them. Now, oddly, another aspect of the same identity, our rural bush-loving identity, supports arguments on the other side, that is, arguments for the use of the new technologies to develop genetically modified crops. Agricultural and biological scientists and farmers have always been innovative, and farming is an area where research and development have delivered enormous benefits to Australia, making our farming among the most efficient and competitive in the world. For example, using traditional breeding, new crops for dryland agriculture have led to enormously improved yields. I know also that many of the scientists who embraced the new technologies did so in harmony with this strong Australian, this strong identity of being innovative and believing in the benefits of research and invention. In addition, these scientists that I know were motivated to use genetic modification specifically to protect the environment by, for example, developing crops that don't require heavy insecticide use. And I'm sure we'll hear more about these types of issues from our speakers. So we see our identity feeding into both sides of that argument. But I'd also like to suggest that the debate around genetic modification and its application to food, and we'll hear increasingly to power, will define our identity over the coming years. Like the climate change debate, the genetic modification debate will tell us a lot about how we respond to risk. It's a problem that humans have a great deal of trouble dealing with, the concept of risk. How do we calculate risk? And when do we as a society decide that a risk is high enough or outweighs the potential benefits to take preventative action? To illustrate this problem with assessing risk, when the first guidelines on the use of recombinant DNA were established at the Asilomar Conference in 1975, the harshest restrictions on experimentation were reserved for species that were most closely related to humans or were disease-causing organisms. And pretty much the restrictions fell away from there as species became less closely related to us. And in fact, some of the weakest restrictions were placed on plant research. This situation has been quite dramatically reversed over those 35 years, as many of us have come to accept the role of recombinant DNA techniques in improving our health, while rejecting a role for the same technologies in plant and animal breeding. Our identity will also be influenced by how we respond to stark choices with regard to agriculture for the third world. For example, genetic modification offers the potential to improve the nutritional value of some poorly nutritious third world crops, which could save, let alone improve, the lives of many. Many third world nations are choosing to develop and adopt these strains, but are also being told by members of the first world that they shouldn't, because of our perception of the dangers involved. Our attitude to this question will say a lot about who we are and how we engage with our neighbours. Now, back to today's session. We've been through a period of time that started with extraordinary claims about the benefits of genetic engineering. Some, but not all, of these claims have been realised. But at the same time, we've seen a vigorous argument put forward that any genetic modification, particularly of crops, is inherently dangerous and should be forbidden. It's my view that nearly 40 years after the first successful genetic engineering methods were developed, it's now time for a more careful discussion of the use of this technology in terms of the risks and benefits. To help us frame that discussion, we have four eminent speakers here today. Associate Professor Ben Hankamer from the Institute of Molecular Biosciences at the University of Queensland, Dr. Liz Dennis from the CSIRO Division of Plant Industry in Canberra, Professor Phil Batterham from our own Department of Genetics here at the University of Melbourne, and Dr. Paul Chambers from the Australian Wine Research Institute in Adelaide. The first speaker is Ben Hankamer. Ben is a principal investigator at the Institute for Molecular Bioscience at the University of Queensland, as I just said. Over the past 10 years, he's focused on the development of environmentally friendly, high-efficiency biofuel production systems. This is a rapidly expanding area of biotechnology. His specialisation is in the structural biology of the photosynthetic machinery, which drives the conversion of solar energy into chemical energy or fuels. Using this knowledge, he embarked on the targeted engineering of green algae for high-efficiency biofuel production. To facilitate this work, he founded the Solar Biofuels Consortium, which he now directs. The consortium includes 8 international teams and conducts a coordinated research program of parallel research streams that include economic analysis, a variety of aspects of scientific research, and bioreactor scale-up. Would you join me in welcoming Ben to speak to you?
Thank you, Robert, and thank you to the organisers for inviting me. So, obviously this session this afternoon is on crops and on fuel, and what I wanted to do is to provide a general overview of the work that we do. There we go. I wanted to put this picture up. It was a picture that I was provided with by Michael Hegelberg from Arizona State University, and I like it because it basically demonstrates pictorially what plants do, and that is catch solar energy to do work, and they store the energy that they catch from the sun to make chemical energy, which can be stored as the form of food or products that you can convert to fuels, such as oils. You can use certain types of algae for hydrogen production, for example. You can use the biomass and convert it to methane through fermentation, and also the fermentation of sugar products to ethanol. This picture is one that I wanted to put up in order to try and just illustrate the problems that we're facing. So over the last few decades, actually, our population worldwide has expanded enormously. And so now we're about 6.8 billion people. And it's anticipated that we will be about 9 billion people by 2050. And all of us, therefore, will require more food. We will require feed for animals in order to provide that food. We will require fresh water, fuel, and also chemical feedstocks. And so there's a whole range of products that we will need increasingly as a society. And to give you an idea about this, recently the UK chief scientist issued a paper in which he stated that we will require something of the order of 30 to 50% more of each of those products by 2050, which is a huge amount of extra production that we require. And you might note the fact that at the moment we are faced with rising fuel prices. Now, there's been a lot of debate about that, whether that's related to biofuels, whether it's related to the distribution of products, or whether it's simply that we've plateaued in our ability to produce the arable land that we have. But one thing that we will have to do is to adapt to all the production of all of these products in the context of climate change, one where we might anticipate that production would go down, but also that we have to move towards more CO2 neutral types of systems. Actually, let me just pop back. One more point I wanted to make is the chemical feedstocks one is also an interesting one. There's a whole range of products that we make from oil, etc. And yesterday, Matt Ridley gave a beautiful talk and was talking about the developments and the rapid increase in gross domestic product per person that we have seen over the last few decades and how that has improved through inventiveness. And one thing that is clear at the moment, at least over the last 20 years or so, 30 years of trend, is that the amount of gross domestic product that we produce is directly correlated with the amount of fuel that we use. Similarly, products such as, for example, fish oils, which can be traditionally been produced from fish, are now being extracted from krill, which, of course, the feedstocks for fish, and they often get it from algae. So the consortium that I founded is really working on using algae for biofuel production, and we've done a lot of economic analysis. I won't go into the details of this, but it shows often that there's value of co-producing things like biomass for animal feed or high-value products. So what we do is a range of things, and what we'd like to do, ideally, the technology was really inspired by the ability to use non-arable land to site algae on non-arable land positions, and therefore eliminating that food versus fuel issue that has been raised through first-generation biofuel crops. The ability for certain algae to grow in saline water streams, I wouldn't say at the moment that we're there at any commercial level with saline systems, except for high-value product production. But it's something that we need to look at. And the other one is the ability to use carbon dioxide, because that's what plants use during photosynthesis. And so you have the ability to close that loop of CO2 emissions if you can use that CO2 for the production of biomass. There's obviously a whole range of work to be done in the biology, both through traditional breeding and through GM crops. And there's a whole range of projects being conducted in the space of engineering. So there's a range of systems from open ponds through to closed reactor systems of many different designs. And so at the end, there are a whole range of products, for example, pigments that we have come to use a lot, beta-carotenes for the egg and fish industry, oils for biodiesel, methane for fuel production is a major focus now in Europe. Hydrogen is also another one that's an interesting one in the context of climate change. If you want to move to 80% CO2 emissions reductions by 2050, hydrogen might be something that we need to consider. The other interesting point is that you can actually take the biomass and you can put it through a controlled burning process called pyrolysis. And that generates a charcoal-like product and effectively allows you to sequester carbon. So one of the things that you need to think about is that we don't only need to limit our emissions of CO2, we actually need to reverse it. So we're already above a level that the IPCC has deemed as being dangerous and that we need to limit our emissions. But ultimately, if we continue rising at the rate we're at, we're going to have to come down again. And so we need technologies to actually sequester carbon. And this is one of those applications that could be used. Here's a vision kind of figure. And this is not from here, I've referenced it there at the bottom, but the idea really is to show some kind of bioreactor system or open pond system on non-arable land. Now, within the context of what we do, we've gone more down the closed reactor system simply because the use of large open ponds would require a great deal of water, though with saline systems that may be possible. But there are a whole range of different designs that you can see here. There are a lot of visionary statements. For example, this picture you see here on the right is pretty much the same picture as you see there now. It's just that Photoshop has changed it from water to soil. And so there's been a lot of hype in the area. We aren't there in terms of commercial production yet, but it's certainly a vision statement that we should be aware of. Here are a range of different types of reactors. The one that you see on the right-hand side at the bottom costs about 100 euros a square meter. We need to get down for biofuel production around the $10 or $20 mark, something like that. So this website I just put up in order to demonstrate, you can go and have a look at this website, World Clocks, and see that the population is rising and the productive land is going down. Actually, we have about 4% of our land is arable, 3.9, and going down. 25% of of the surface area of the Earth is non-arable. And when you do the calculations, for all our fuel production, you would require something of the order of 3 to 4% at current efficiencies for biofuels. So you can raise the efficiency, and you need to think about moving towards non-arable land. Now, there's often this sort of black and white position of GMOs versus the environment. And one of the points that I wanted to make, really, that it really isn't quite that black and white. And we have to decide what future we want, you know, and also what we can responsibly aim for. So, for example, one might aim for an environmental ideal of having a pristine GMO-free environment. But you also have to face the fact that we will need to face 9 billion people. Now, I'm not saying that GMOs will be all the solutions for this, but it's certainly something that we need to put into the mix and consider. All right. So the main concerns that people have raised are generally the health of GM foods, patent-based controls of crops and food security, whether there's certain corporations which control that, degradation of native environments through mass cultivation of GM crops, the disruption of food chains. So, for example, if you introduce genes which confer insect tolerance, resistance, that sort of thing. And the other one is scientists playing God, which was an issue that was raised this morning as well and is in the previous session. On the benefit side, really, that we can hopefully achieve improved crop production, more food on less land, if you like. With algae, we have the ability to breed much more rapidly than with traditional crop systems, so we have life cycles of a day or hours, and so we can go through multiple refinements to generate a range of different products. And Liz will also be talking about those in crop plants later on. Salt tolerance is another one that we're actively looking at, the ability to use algae and increase their salt tolerance so that we can use the vast majority of water that's available to us. We aren't personally looking at chemical resistance to pesticides, but it's clearly an issue in the plant area. New products, a whole range of products, so you can target that solar energy into a particular product stream, a particular form of chemical energy. Virus resistance is another one, so you can have resistant crop production. And the other point is that really that Australia is an important agricultural exporter. And so for this reason, it's important also that we develop those opportunities for Australian farmers. And there's also an element of environmental protection in the fact that if we don't do anything about CO2 emissions and producing clean fuels for the future, we'll be faced with other environmental damage, which we will need to deal with. So, you know, there's pros and cons to everything, and those are things that we have to put in the mix and discuss. So this is my final slide. And I just wanted to summarize it to say that with careful thought, good science, good legislation and controls, the benefits of GMOs could be obtained with benefits to health, e.g. vitamin A rice, and natural habitats, e.g. microalgal systems for biofuel production on non-arable land. Not all GMO systems will be beneficial, nor will all of them be bad, and the good should be selected and the bad should be rejected. And that, I think, is something that has come out of this discussion from yesterday and today about what our society wants and where we would like to take it. Thank you.
Thanks, Ben. I forgot to mention that the way that we've structured this session is that there'll be short talks from each of us, and that will be followed by plenty of time to ask questions. So I'll ask you to hold your questions until the end of the session. The next speaker is Liz Dennis. Liz is a CSIRO fellow with a long-term interest in and contribution to plant molecular biology. She's made crucial contributions to our understanding of gene regulation in plants, in flowering, and in the molecular basis of fibre development in cotton. She's a fellow of the Australian Academy of Science, and in 2000 she was the co-winner of the inaugural Prime Minister's Prize for Science for her work on flowering. So I'd like to ask you to join me in welcoming Liz.
Thanks, Rob, and thanks, Patrick, for and your workers for inviting me to talk to this session. Now, as Ben has said, one of the great problems facing the world today is how to feed the 9 million people that are predicted to inhabit the planet by the year 2040. And that means that we have to grow as much food in the next 30 years as has ever been grown in the history of the world. And if we fail to do this, I think the results will be political instability and food riots, and Australia, as an important exporter of food, has an important role to play in solving this food problem. As well as making more food, food needs to be more nutritional. As we've got people... Many people in Asia and Africa using single crop as a staple, and many of those crops are deficient, in particular vitamins or micronutrients. So we have to try and solve that problem. And as well, there are lifestyle diseases such as diabetes that altered nutrition in food could probably help as well. So we need to grow this food on less land and probably with more consideration for the environmental consequences of farming than we've had in the past. And all this in the context of changing climate. So the problems are quite immense, and I'd say that we need to use all the tools we have available, and that includes genetic modification of plants. So as was pointed out this morning, all organisms contain DNA in the nucleus. And that DNA contains all the genes, that is the sequences that code for proteins, but as well it contains the sequences that ensure those genes are active in the right place, at the right time, and the right amount. For example, leaf genes are active in leaves, root genes are active in roots. So we have the genes and the products they encode, but as well we have the control sequences. So what do we do when we make a GM plant? Well, we take a gene, and that gene, the coding sequence, can come from any organism because DNA... The DNA code is universal, so the gene can be taken from any organism, but the control sequences to ensure that it's active in the right places are generally taken from plants. So we take a gene, we fit it with the right control sequences, and we splice it into the genome of the crop plant that we're interested in modifying. So usually, there's only one or two genes altered in the whole context of the 30,000 genes that make up a plant. Now, should we be worried about eating these genes? Well, every mouthful that we eat of our food contains many thousands of genes. And these genes are just processed by the digestive system along with any food. So where do I think that GM can assist us tackle this problem of improved food and food security and food nutrition? So the major crops that have been modified at the moment are cotton, maize, soybean, and canola. And all these crops have a large GM production. And if you look at this slide, you can see that the level of GM crops from 1986 to 2006 has really dramatically increased, going from almost zero to 125 million hectares worldwide, and that's continued increasing since 2008. And many, many farmers have embraced this technology. Those 13 million farmers are both in developing and in developed countries. So GM has really increased in globally. So what do we think that GM can do? How can it assist? And I must say it assists in normal traditional plant breeding. This is on top of traditional plant breeding. So the first thing is increased productivity, more food. Secondly, less destruction of the environment. And thirdly, improved health through enhanced nutrition. So let's look at productivity. And I might point out that some of these, the things that we are finding out by using gene technology to understand plants have actually given us some very surprising results. And here's one shown in this slide. This is a wheat plant. And by knocking out where a gene is active, a gene involved in starch metabolism, we found that scientists in CSIRO have found that you can get something like a 30% increase in yield by altering where a gene is expressed that affects where the mobilisation of starch. So this sort of unexpected result can really lead to increases in productivity. A second way of increasing productivity is to improve disease resistance. There's a lot of crop loss through the world through diseases. And, for example, this is a barley and a virus called barley yellow dwarf virus, which stunts barley. You can see on the right-hand side of the picture a plant that's infected with the barley yellow dwarf virus. But by making a GM construct that knocks down the expression of the genes, the activity of the genes from the virus, we can protect the plants against the virus. So this sort of technology where you improve disease resistance is a fairly straightforward way of using GM to improve crop productivity. Long-chain omega-3 oils are essential to our diets, and we can't make them. We have to gain these omega-3 oils. We generally get it from eating fish, but as you've probably read, the fish catches in the world are decreasing, and there's increasing pressure on our fish stocks, so we really have to get them from somewhere else. So by taking genes from marine microalgae and inserting them, the genes that make these omega oils, that convert the omega oils that we can't do, if by adding these genes to plants, we can make the oil profile of oilseed plants look exactly like the oil profile of tuna. So we believe that eating these plants will do you just as good with the omega-3 oils as eating fish. And so this provides an alternate source of these essential oils, which are important for at least for cardiovascular health, but also for other health reasons. We can take the pressure off the fish and use plants. For the developing world, you've probably read about golden rice. Well, rice, something like 120 million people worldwide use rice as the sole source of food. Now, rice is lacking in vitamin A, and something like 1 to 2 million people a year die through vitamin A deficiency, and 500,000 people have irreversible blindness, and a lot of those are children. So by incorporating genes that make the precursor of vitamin A, provitamin A, a beta carotene, in rice, in the part of rice that you eat, we hope, or it's hoped, that the if people would eat this golden rice, then they would overcome the vitamin A deficiency. This rice contains two genes, one from maize and one from a bacterium, that together, when added to the rice, allow rice to make the precursor of vitamin A that humans now can convert to vitamin A, in this way overcoming the lack of vitamin A in rice. It's hoped that this rice will be available in 2012 after doing all the field trials and tests that are needed. Now to the environment. Cotton has been traditionally a crop that is very subject to insect pests. And in Australia, it's particularly subjected to insect pests. We have a lot of pests that eat cotton. And before the advent of GM cotton, there were 14 crops used, up to 14 sprays like this of insecticide. Now, insecticides are not very good for people or for fish or for insects that aren't even for insects that aren't pests. So it's very non-discriminatory, and it can kill other animals, other organisms, and other insects. So in cotton, two genes have been added from a bacterium, a pair of genes, to ensure that resistance doesn't build up. These genes are from a bacterium called Bacillus thuringiensis, which is the bacteria have been used in horticulture as dipel for many years as a protection, but it's much more efficient to incorporate the genes into the cotton. And you can see here how the uptake of GM cotton in Australia from something like 10% in 1996 to 2008 has gone from 10% of the crop now to over 90% of the crop. And accompanying that has been a 90% reduction in the amount of pesticides used, which has really had very good effects for the environment. And so using these genes, just these two genes that specifically kill Lepidopteran insects, which are the main pests of the cotton crop, we find that the beneficial insects, the insects that aren't pests, are spared, they're not targeted, and as well as that, there's not all that insecticide going into the environment. So I think that's had a substantial improvement on the environment in the cotton growing areas. So, in summary, what do I think? I think we have to use all the tools that are available to us to try and innovate our agriculture, and this includes GM. At present, we use GM in a number of crops. We don't use it in wheat. We only use it to try and investigate the biology of wheat. You know, what genes are important to get particular benefits. I hope in the future that we can use GM crops as well as using the technology to understand the genes involved, so that in future we'll have non-GM, traditional breeding, but we'll have the added benefit of GM to enhance our production. Thank you.
Thank you, Liz. The next speaker is Professor Phil Batterham. Phil is a professor of genetics at the University of Melbourne. He carries out research on insect pest control using insecticides and genetically modified organisms. And he's passionate about global health and development issues. And evidence for this is that last year he organised the United Nations Conference on the Millennium Development Goals held here in Melbourne. I can also tell you that Phil puts a lot of his energy into engaging with the community on science. So it's a pleasure to welcome Phil for the next talk.
Thanks, Rob. So we've already heard from the preceding speakers that we really need to be more effective in producing food. We need higher productivity per hectare because the number of people in the world is rapidly ramping up and the amount of land available for agriculture is ramping down. The ratio gets worse as we speak. And obviously we're seeing that factored into food prices, which are high here and all over the world and getting worse every year and will continue to rise. So part of the solution to improved agricultural productivity is to cut productivity losses, which are due to insect pests and to diseases. So on this slide you see a couple of major insect pests. The one on the top is called the cotton bollworm. It's a bit of a misnomer, which I'll come to in a moment, but it is probably the biggest agricultural pest on the face of the earth. The one on the bottom is a local friend. We call it the Australian sheep blowfly, but it's no friend to sheep because it causes a lot of pain and suffering and causes great control costs for Australian agriculture. Back to the cotton bollworm, you see here the distribution of two very, very closely related species of cotton bollworm, and together with CSIRO, we are involved in a genome project to analyse these species and maybe to look for their Achilles heel. But their global impact in the negative sense every year is estimated at $5 billion US. So that's a huge impact, and it's not just on cotton, because this species goes after almost anything that's green and vertical, and there are about 200 species of agricultural crop plants that it will call home and food and devour. So one of the traditional ways of controlling insect pests, and in fact a major way of controlling insect pests, is with chemicals. This picture was taken a couple of years ago in India. It was taken in a street where every shop basically sells chemicals because the control of insect pests is such a major issue. There are about 20 million cotton farmers in India. Now, the application of insecticides in India is not quite like it is in Australia with those crop-dusting plains. Here you see someone walking through a field with a backpack, and they might do that 15 to 30 times in a season, spraying a chemical of unknown mode of action. And I like to show this slide and ask people, where is the maximum exposure? And I think it's on the person applying the insecticide. Insect pests can be devastating, and you see a picture here of a couple of plants, a couple of cauliflower plants, and one has been absolutely devoured and is useless by the moth that you see there, which is the diamondback moth. So the problem is real and the problem is big. So what do insecticides do, and how do insects become resistant to them? So on this slide you can see my knowledge of chemistry detailed. My knowledge of chemistry is very basic. So here is an insecticide shown as a blue shape. It enters a cell and it binds to a protein shown in orange. The protein is the target. Now, it's the interaction between the insecticide and the protein that is going to kill the insect. Well, insects become resistant to insecticides, and they do it one of two ways. In this cartoon here, the insecticide enters the cell, and these little yellow circles represent enzymes which are produced in greater abundance in the resistant organism, and they break the chemical down before it gets to the target. And this usually happens in the insect gut, which is shown beautifully from a slide from my lab. This second mechanism is target site modification. Here you get a mutation in the gene that produces the target, and the target is slightly altered by this mutation. It can carry on its normal function, but it's unable to bind the insecticide. And most targets are in the nervous system, and here's a lovely picture of insect nervous system developing. So targets become very important in helping us to understand what insecticides do. And it turns out that we are really ignorant of insecticide targets. Given the huge amount of insecticides that are used in the world, you might imagine that we have a very clear idea of what they do. But in fact, many insecticides are released into the field, and at the point in time they are first used in the field, we don't know what they do at all. So I've actually been able to generate quite a lot of research funding in using different chemicals that are currently being applied in the field in Australia and elsewhere and actually finding out what they do. And we do something very simple. We take this organism here, which is not a pest, this lovely little fly Drosophila, and we make mutants and basically screen with insecticides for mutants that are resistant, and then we find the genes. Now, it turns out that the genes that we find that encode targets happen to be the same genes that produce targets of these insecticides in insect pests. So we can, in fact, use this organism to not only find what the targets are for chemicals that are out there in the field, but, in fact, we can predict what the targets would be for insecticides that are yet to be used. And a couple of really nice examples from work done in my lab by Trent Perry, and he's looking at these ion channels, which are very complex structures in the nervous system, carry nerve impulses, and he was able to find that for compounds that resemble nicotine, neonicotinoids, there are a couple of subunits of this complex structure that are in fact targeted by these compounds. And for another class of compounds, which are actually biopesticides and supposedly a little more environmentally friendly, they do basically the same thing, but they target a different subunit of the receptor. I very strongly believe, based on my research, that it's very important to understand these targets so that we can be confident that, insecticides are acting for good, to try and ensure that insecticides would do little collateral damage in the environment. And unfortunately, so many of the insecticides that are available for use today do a huge amount of collateral damage, as Liz has alluded to. I think these kind of understandings that come from our research can allow us to design better insecticides that would have lower environmental impact. And in my lab at the moment, we're looking at combination therapies that would allow us to use less insecticide to have a greater impact. Now, in contrast to our ignorance of the targets of chemical insecticides, we have an exquisitely detailed knowledge of GM insecticides, the BT toxin that Liz referred to. So I won't go through this cartoon in gory detail, but here's this BT toxin. It's being ingested. It's being ingested from a BT plant, a transgenic plant. It's eaten by the caterpillar of the moth. It finds its way down into the gut. It attaches to the gut membrane, and it drills holes into the gut membrane, which just leaks like a sieve, and it kills the caterpillar. We know in great detail what this insecticide is doing. Now, because of my interest in the developing world, we, as a group, got involved in an international initiative to produce cauliflower and cabbages that were transgenic, carrying BT genes. In fact, two different BT genes that had different targets in the gut. And this was an international network project, and it was a very interesting private-public partnership. The deal was that a corporation, Nunnums, would produce the transgenic crops, and then a group of public partners with public money would basically evaluate these crops in terms of their safety and efficacy, preparing these crops for registration around the world. There was a deal struck initially that Nunnums would control the distribution of these crops in the developing world, whereas the distribution in the developing world would be controlled by these public parties. And this was a very large undertaking. It received high-level endorsement, very importantly endorsement from the Indian government right up to the level of the Prime Minister. And this was important because India was one of the first places where these crops would be used. And the process of producing this crop took several years, and I just show a timeline here from the first transgenic plants that were produced, and you go through this timeline and you see just a huge number of steps. And this step here is one where we know that we've got something that's probably worthy of release in the field. So several years of exhaustive research and then a whole lot more before you could get to a point of registration. And so this project was very successful, able to produce cauliflowers and cabbages that looked a whole lot healthier when they were challenged to moths than did their non-GM counterparts. Very exciting. Until someone arrives in your lab one day to autoclave to kill all of your plant stocks, all of your seed, and goes through those field houses in India to do the same. Because the burden of trying to get these products onto the market and released anywhere in the world was a challenge that was a bridge too far. Because there were issues of liability and different liabilities regimes that would occur around the world. Stewardship issues in that you had to take responsibility as a corporation for every last seed, basically, that was produced, no matter how much other people would abuse it along the way, and a really uncertain approvals process. And so the corporate partner basically pulled out and destroyed all of the plants, and almost a decade's research just went down the drain. And some of these regulatory requirements are absolutely bizarre. This is the most bizarre, that you basically force feed cows in India, sacred animal, cauliflowers and cabbages, to see whether they are impacted by these GM crops. They're not, but you can't really test them. You can only look at milk and blood. You can't kill them. You can't do autopsies. You can't do anything. So I have a fairly balanced view, I like to think, about the use of chemical insecticides because I work on them, GM crops because I've worked on them. And as with the other speakers you've heard today, I really believe that we need to make rational decisions. We are using massive amounts of chemicals to produce our food. The figures are actually hard to get, but about 1 kilogram for each one of you in the audience is used. And these are potent chemicals that are active at exquisitely low concentrations. And we don't know that much about what they do. And we have some false dichotomies. So as an organic farmer, you can't use synthetic chemicals, but you can use natural chemicals that are incredibly similar to the synthetic chemicals. You can apply the BT bacteria, but you can't grow a plant that has a BT gene in it. And then there are these distracting arguments. One night I went to a pancake restaurant, which shall remain nameless, and they said they don't use any GM product because it might cause allergies. Now think about that statement. What's in a pancake? Eggs, milk, flour. Can anybody think of any more potent allergens than those? And they're saying that something else might be an allergen. So that concerns me. And I am very concerned about the activity of the anti-GM environmental movement because I think they work to preserve status quo. I think they work to kill debate. And if you're preserving status quo, you really should line up with the chemical companies and ask for money because what you're doing is actually preserving their profits. And I'm very concerned about the level of debate that we have in this country. So what I would be calling for is consistent application of rational decision-making principles by governments, primary producers, environmental movement, and the general public. We need to consider all options that are at our disposal. We need to choose the best options for each circumstance in terms of cost and effectiveness, low environmental impact, safety for humans. And we need to apply equal rigour in considering GM, insecticide, and organic options. And the best solution will not always be GM, and the worst solution will not always be GM. We need to turn our brains on and evaluate what's available to us and make good decisions. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil. The next speaker is Paul Chambers. Paul is currently the research manager of the Australian Wine Research Institute in Adelaide. He has expertise in molecular genetics with a focus on the genetics of the yeast used in winemaking, baking and brewing. His current research focuses on the development of new yeast strains with improved performance and quality outputs. He also has a particular interest in the evolution of domesticated species. It's a pleasure to have you here. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you, Rob, and thank you, Patrick, for the invitation to present today. It's a real privilege to be here. I'm going to be talking to you about wine and about the Australian wine industry and the connection with that and Australian identity, and connect that up with how science and technology has played a central role in the success of the industry. Wine has been in Australia since first white settlement. There are records going back to the very first ships coming out to Australia bringing vines with them. Australia, you may not know, Australia has some of the oldest vineyards in the world. European vines were wiped out by phylloxera and had to be replanted some time ago. Australian vines weren't hit by that. So we have the most amazing history of winemaking in Australia. The Hill of Grace Vineyard in Eden Valley in South Australia is over 150 years old. Difficult to put an exact age on it. It was planted originally for the local Lutheran community there to provide altar wine for the local church, and maybe churches today should have a think about that. I think we'd get a lot more people along to congregations if we had a drop of Hill of Grace to go with the communion. And it was for the local community. So wine didn't really become a part of the sort of pan-Australian identity until much later times. It tended to sit in local communities and serve those local communities in various ways. It's really come of age in the last 40 to 50 years, and we can probably trace that back to something else that's been shaping Australian identity, and that's migration. Migrants from the Mediterranean brought wonderful foods and wine with them and changed the Australian cultural landscape enormously in the process of doing that. So we've ended up now with fantastic foods and wonderful wines. The Australian wine industry has been very, very proactive in growing its industry and in producing top quality wines at affordable prices. And it's used science and technology unashamedly to get there. The Australian industry embraces science and technology and has utilized it to grow one of the most successful wine industries in the world. I'm biased, of course. Grape growers and winemakers of Australia pay my salary to do this, but I think the history books would support what I'm saying in this respect. The title of the talk is perhaps a little bit pretentious. The title of the talk came about following a second glass of wine, so wine has actually played a part in shaping the title of this presentation. I got a call late last week, or an email late last week, saying, Paul, you've got to get your talk in by close of business tomorrow. And I had just finished dinner and had some fantastic Pinot from Mornington Peninsula. So I was in a really mellow frame of mind, cruised along nicely. So came up with this pretentious title, Tailoring Wine Yeast to Sustain Dionysus. I'll talk about Dionysus a little bit later as we move into this, but the real theme of the talk here is wine yeast and what we're doing with wine yeast to serve the Australian industry. Just a quick reminder of what yeast are. These are fungi. Yeast are unicellular, single-celled fungi. They come in a range of shapes and sizes, but fairly limited. We have these rather, just get the pointer, these rather rude-looking yeasts down here, and these beautiful yeasts here. These are the ones that I work on. And the distance, the evolutionary distance between these two yeasts is about as great as the evolutionary distance between any of us and one of these. They're hugely, hugely divergent. There's probably about 600,000 different species of yeast, but there's really only one or two that are of great importance in an industrial context. And they're the yeasts that are used in brewing, in baking, winemaking, chocolate making as well, by the way. Cocoa beans are fermented as part of the process of making chocolate, as are cocoa beans. And more recently, used in bioethanol production and pharmaceutical production. These are domesticated yeasts, yeasts that we've bred specifically to use for industrial application. The domesticated yeast that I'm most interested in, the organism that I love, is this thing here, Saccharomyces cerevisiae. Saccharomyces cerevisiae, it's about a tenth the size of a cell in your body and about 10 times bigger than a bacterial cell. Quite beautiful. I don't know if you can see from where you're sitting, there are these scars on the surface where the cell divides, it buds and breaks off to produce daughter cells. It goes through sexual and asexual reproduction. If you could actually shrink yourself down small enough, think about a science fiction thing, if you could shrink yourself down small enough and climb into one of these cells, it's going to look like one of your cells. It has an, it's like a little metropolis in there. There are little vehicles running along tram tracks delivering things from one compartment to another, compartments doing different functions of the cell. We know so much about this yeast cell. Nobel Prizes have been won on the back of this yeast cell because it's very like our cells. It's used in cancer research. It's used in research on Alzheimer's disease and all kinds of things. But the ones I most love are the ones that make wine, not just because I love wine, but because we can learn so much about evolution and biology from studying these yeasts in a wine context. So products of domestication, these yeasts are domesticated, and domesticated organisms are things that have been bred, produced by humans, shaped by humans, often over many thousands of years. Here's two examples of dogs. These things are actually very similar genetically. They have a common ancestor somewhere around about the Middle East, going back maybe 10 to 15,000 years ago. So they've been around a long time, dogs, and have been shaped by humans by breeding programs. Nothing like yeast, of course. I just want to illustrate the point that domestication produces extreme forms. Darwin dedicated the first couple of chapters of his Origin of the Species to domestication to illustrate how evolution occurs, or to use it as an evidence for evolution having occurred. Domestication of this beautiful wine yeast then occurred probably as long ago as 7,000 years ago, the starting points. We have evidence for wine production in Iran about 6,000 to 7,000 years ago, beer production about 6,000 years ago. We don't know how it all got started, of course, but my best guess is something like this. You have someone who has grape vines and they produce grapes for fruit, and the fruit's delicious and they love it. And one day they pick the fruit and forget about it. And they come back to it a week later, and the juice from that fruit is actually a little bit more interesting than the fruit. So much more interesting, they then decide to go through the first stages of what I call biotechnology in this sense. They pick grapes, they change the way they do it, they'll change the kind of inoculation regime. Not scientifically in that it's informed, they don't know microorganisms are involved in this. They just know that if they use this barrel over here, they get fantastic wine from these grapes over here. And they pass that on culturally from one generation to the next, not through scientifically peer-reviewed journals, but it's nonetheless a form of science, early science at work. So wine, beer making, etc., has been with us and has shaped science in lots of different ways. So I would argue winemaking is probably one of the first biotechnologies. So this is where Dionysus comes into this presentation. Dionysus was the Greek god of the grapevine, wine, and pleasure. Pleasure's an important thing in life, a very important thing in life. Dionysus then should be part, I think, of our considerations of where we go with our technologies. We don't want to lose that tradition of wine moving into our new technologies. So I'm going to keep Dionysus on these slides from here, just to remind us of a connection with an age-old tradition. Dionysus was reinvented by the Romans as Bacchus, so you may have come across Bacchus if you haven't heard of Dionysus. So humans then have been satisfying Dionysus, this pleasure god, this wine god, for thousands of years. We've been moving grapevines around the world. We've been taking clones of them to get new varieties. We've been inadvertently selecting yeast and some of the bacteria that we find in fermentations to get good outcomes. The new biotechnology then. The new biotechnology knows, we now know the microorganisms that are involved in fermentation, and we've isolated them, and we have lots of different wine yeast strains, probably hundreds of different wine yeast strains out there. By strain, I mean a genetic lineage. Different wine yeast produce different outcomes in fermentations. You can get quite different wines. So this figure here is supposed to illustrate that you take
some grapes, you crush them, you separate those grapes off into different fermenters, ferment them with different yeast strains, and you end up with wines that consumers describe in different ways. So this one's a bit sort of pineapple-y with a bit of banana and a bit of passion fruit, whereas this wine came out with, I can't see what that one is, a mixed fruit at the bottom there. So we get different fruity characters, different flavours for different palates using different yeast. It's not as exaggerated as this cartoon would suggest, but even I can pick it out, and I've got a lousy, lousy sense of taste and smell. So I can pick the differences of different wine yeasts. So that's the first stages of biotechnology, but we can go beyond that. Some of the things that we would like to be able to do would be to add new flavours to the wines that we get, make more complex flavours, bring different mixes of flavours together. We would also like to be able to reduce the alcohol content of wine. Now, this sounds very anti-Dionysian. It sounds very, but it's actually not, because remember, it's all about pleasure. It's about trying to get the best, trying to get good things out of life. And I would argue that if we can get the alcohol content down in wine, that has a real positive impact on health, and that's important. But you can actually develop an awful lot more fruit and mouthfeel character in wine with less alcohol. There are many other targets as well, but they're two that are perhaps easy to convey in a short session. So how is this achieved? There are essentially two approaches that we use currently. The group that I manage, we have about 20 scientists who work on these projects in yeast and come from a range of backgrounds. And some of them focus more on traditional breeding techniques. Saccharomyces cerevisiae has a sexual cycle, so you can mate it, you can follow breeding lines, you can follow the genetics of it. You can also mutagenize it with chemicals. Actually, it's quite ironic that this is acceptable, although it's non-GM. So you can zap an organism that's going to go into the food world with UV irradiation, induce thousands of mutations at random across the genome, and if you're happy with the product, it goes out onto the shelves soon after they're on. So, whereas with the GM approach that I'm going to talk about in a second, we have a level of precision and care that we can introduce into the development of our yeast strains and a quality assurance, which is perhaps much stronger, much better than the more traditional approaches. So we use traditional approaches. There are some things that is good for, very complex genetic traits. It's good to use traditional approaches for those because we don't necessarily know which genes to target. But the main driver is this note that I've got at the bottom of the screen here, and I need to emphasize that the Australian wine industry does not use any genetically modified organisms in wine production. And the driver for that is really consumer sentiment, particularly in export markets. We can't afford to risk losing export markets by bringing GMOs into wine production at this time. The new biotechnology, bringing GMOs in, as I said before, brings a precision with it. We've actually generated some wine yeast that produce substantially less alcohol and have the potential to make really, really good wine. But we have those sitting on the laboratory shelf currently, hoping that one day we'll have an opportunity to take them out to test in a real-world setting. We have some amazing strains that produce flavours that are absolutely phenomenal. But again, we're not using those currently. They're sitting on the shelf. They show us what the potential is. They show us what a yeast cell is capable of doing, but we're not able to get there with the traditional approaches. Something I'd like to mention here in terms of GMOs, there are essentially two major classes of GMO that we're interested in the work we do. So-called self-cloned GMOs, and then transgenic GMOs. Self-cloned GMOs have no foreign DNA in them at all. They have only Saccharomyces cerevisiae genetic material inside of them. We make them, however, by using genetic engineering techniques. We remove any foreign DNA that's been involved in the process getting there. But the pathway to get there, the technology itself, is what defines a GMO in an Australian, New Zealand, and European context. In the US, self-cloned organisms wouldn't be regarded as genetically modified organisms. Transgenics, then, are organisms where we take genes across species barriers, so we borrow genes from other organisms and introduce them into our host rains, and we have some of those as well, but our view is that consumer sentiment is going to be far more likely to be accepting of self-cloned, non-transgenic, in other words, GMOs, before transgenic varieties. So which is the best, traditional versus the new biotechnology? The new biotechnology opens up so many vistas for us that I'm hoping that one day we'll be able to convince consumers out there that this is the best and safest way to go in generating new foods and new products for the food industry. This is another representation of Dionysus. This is much later. The earlier one that I showed was a statue of Dionysus that was a Roman reproduction of a Greek statue. I think it dates back to about the 2nd century. This is from the 16th century by an Italian artist. And I'm not sure why I put this in. And I think it had something to do with that second glass of wine. So when I went back to the talk after it, I thought, I don't know what I'm... It's presumably when this slide went in, I had something really smart to say, but I don't know what it was. I had written on the slide, sustaining Dionysus, and I think maybe what I was thinking there was that there is something about Australian culture that fits well with this Dionysian attitude, this thing about, you know, we live in a country, it's often referred to as the lucky country. We embrace change, we embrace new things, we have a pioneering attitude, and we love good things, we love the good life. So perhaps that's why I put this slide in. But I do apologise for the pretense, and I'll leave you with one last picture of an Australian landscape. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much to our four speakers. The floor is now open for anyone who has questions, and we already have one hand up. So if we can start with one back there.
Stand up, sure. My name is Bob Phelps. I'm from Gene Ethics, one of the critics groups. I'd like to take up a point made by Phil Batterham. He said, I quote, that the critics just preserve the status quo and stifle debate. So I think it's fair to ask the organisers why there are no critics on the panel today. My other question is about the World Bank and United Nations report, the IAASTD report, which said that... gene manipulation crops, genetically manipulated crops, have no useful role to play in solving climate change, biodiversity loss, hunger or poverty. This is a 2008 report. And a report earlier this year said, from the United Nations as well, said that agroecological farming practices are the way of the future. That with the end of oil and phosphates, which we're confronting, that... gene-manipulated crops merely prop up the existing industrial system, which will have to change. We need to change agriculture, and we need to change it to be in harmony with nature, not against it. Would Phil and the organisers comment? Thank you.
Well, perhaps I'll make an initial comment that it being a festival of ideas, what we wanted to do was to get together a group of people who are looking at the future, who are looking at the ways in which we might be able to apply these technologies, who are thinking about them. Well, that's your opinion. That's the reason why we have a group of people here who are actively engaged in the business of thinking about how these things are done. In terms of viewing the sort of arguments, I'll pass over to Phil to comment on that.
Well, I think we've put arguments, and I don't think any of us are backing off from those. They're based on a huge amount of research that's been done around the world, and we don't have great evidence of cataclysmic events occurring as a result of the use of GM technologies. But I think each of us, you've heard us, each of us calling for scrutiny of all technologies that are applied in the field, and they all do have their downside risks. At the moment in Germany, there are many people who are still very ill. And there's a serious question being asked in the scientific literature about the problems of using manure as fertilisers, because manure is a source of E. coli. And people are seriously questioning whether that has caused this terrible situation in Germany. So we just have to be very open-minded and take all cases, all situations on their merits. And to simply say we will not have GM under any circumstances is incredibly close-minded. We just have to evaluate options and give them equal scrutiny.
Now, there's a question just here, and then one at the back, and I'll keep this in mind.
Hi, my name's David. I'm a scientist myself. I was just wondering how much toxicology testing is done before we're allowed to eat these things, because some of the genes sounds like they're coming from unusual places or sources that we wouldn't usually eat. So I was just wondering whether those proteins that are being produced by the organism might have an effect in the gut, or once, you know, they might have some kind of receptor interactions or something.
As far as I know, that every particularly... Can you hear that? Particularly the BT, that there's been extensive toxicology and extensive study. I mean, every plant that's been released for the BT, the foreign DNA is completely characterised that's in there, and there's something like $10 million spent on the toxicology testing.
The other thing about when we were testing these plants that might have been used in India, you actually have to convince authorities that the only protein that's being produced is the one that you're putting in there. And in terms of BT, because we know what it does, we know that it binds to a particular receptor which does not exist in humans and, in fact, doesn't exist in many other species of insects. The other advantage, of course, is that it's only the pest that happens to be eating the plant that's even exposed to that toxin. If it's a food crop, also humans. But all of the other species of insects that are out there in the environment are not partaking of this meal. So it's very, very targeted.
What's the same level of testing done for all GM crops that we're eating at the moment?
Absolutely. You know, and that's why it's a very challenging environment into which for a company to release a product, because the costs are astronomical to get registration. And if you're going to register it around the world, it has to be registered in every different country and go through their regulatory processes. So you can't just have it declared safe in one place and assume that it just rolls out across the planet. So the costs are enormous.
There was a question up the back. Yes, there, and then I'll come over to this side.
My name is Sandra. I would like to put a question to the panel. What long-term studies have been conducted to assess the long-term effects and impact or genetically modified organisms on our health, future generation genome, and ecology?
Who would like to tackle that one? I mean, I might just make an observation, having been involved in this type of research myself now for a very long time, that we started generating recombinant organisms in the organism that I work on, which is the little fruit fly that that Phil talked about. That work's been going on for the order of 30 years. There's also an equivalent in the plant world called Arabidopsis, where work has been going on for a very long time. Curiously, the requirements for working with that became very, very much tougher after we'd been working with it for about 10 or 15 years. We've now been working with it for decades without a single issue that's been has arisen. I think the question you have to start asking, and I have seen it asked to the federal panel that includes people from the public that looks at the type of legislation that's in place, and that is, when do you consider something safe? I mean, after how many decades? How do we assess what safety is? And as I said in my introduction, I think the problem we have in this is that we have the most extraordinarily odd views of risk. And I think we're seeing that at the moment in sort of the contrast between, say, the around the climate change debate and certainly the GM debate. You would think that, having worked with an organism for that long without having had a single problem, that you might consider it to be safe. But compared with, say, the safety of some of the energy companies, the coal mining companies and so forth. But we don't view it that way. There's a sort of a way that we perceive risk, particularly what we think of as risk of the unknown, that's very hard for us to deal with. Does anyone want to add any comments?
One other thing. Well, firstly, I'm going to be very consistent here and say I'd be calling for longitudinal studies with all options. You know, why limit it to one option? Why should we seriously evaluate the risk with one, not with others? But there was a suggestion in the question that the GM organisms could influence our genomes. And that's just not true. You know, for many years of my life, I used to bring banana sandwiches to work. I did not turn into a banana. And all of us, we've got lots of DNA in our stomach after every meal. So there is nothing unique about the DNA that comes in a GM organism compared to one that is not. Critical question is actually about the protein. Does the protein do anything? And all evidence is, in the case of BT, that it does nothing to humans.
So, question... Yeah. Oh, okay, sorry. I didn't realise you had the mic. No, go ahead.
Robin Anders. I'm optimistic that GM technologies will certainly help solve many of the major problems that we're confronted with, particularly with this growing population. But I am a bit pessimistic that the correct policy decisions will be made by our politicians. The first GM vaccine, hepatitis B vaccine, developed in 1985, it's only really in the last 5 years or so that it's being rolled out in sufficient numbers in the developing world where it will have a dramatic impact on the incidence of liver cancer. You will know better than me how long it took for the GM potato in Europe to be approved, 10 years or more, and it's only been approved, of course, for industrial use, not for human consumption. Some of the problems are chronic problems that GM technologies will help solve, but there is a very acute problem in Uganda at the moment, in neighbouring countries, with the banana bacterial wilt going to cost the Uganda economy maybe $200 million this year. It's threatening the livelihoods and the lives of these people who depend on the banana as their staple food. Professor Batterham mentioned the lack of regulatory frameworks for GM foods, and there is a GM banana that is resistant to the bacterial wilt, but how long is it going to take to roll that out? How many people who are dependent on the banana as their staple diet are going to die? How many small holders are going to walk off their farms?
Would you like to comment on that?
Agreement.
Yes. But I think this is part of the tragedy, is these solutions are available, and yet because particularly from the EU to prevent that release. I think there was a similar situation with GM maize in Mali, I think it was, in one of the African countries where there was plenty of food, but it was forbidden to hand out to the people.
Sorry, next question.
The title says food and power, but there's been no political dimension at all in what you have said. There's been no mention of the behaviour of companies like Monsanto, who are very dominating and very, very immoral in many ways. My name's Betty Kaplan. I've been living and teaching in Africa for the last 14 years, there is in many places plenty of food. It's just that people can't get it, there are problems with transport and so on. But also, in the 1950s, Africa could feed itself. But then because of World Bank and IMF policies, it was suggested that they start growing cash crops for the third world. So where they're growing food, it's for export to our table, not so much our tables, but European tables, flowers for European tables, and so on. And these are all political decisions. Thank you.
Can I just... I just want to comment on the use of the word power. We were using power in terms of the power that energy is used to provide, and the reason we used power rather than energy was because I have a faculty that contains a large number of physicists that keep trying to explain to us and to others that it's actually not energy that's the problem, it's power that's the problem in terms of generating our needs. So it wasn't meant to indicate political power, so I apologise for having misled you on that. Let me see.
There's not much to question in terms of what you've said, but I think one thing that's really important to note is that at the moment there's enough food for everybody. It is only a question of getting it distributed to the right place so that everybody has enough to eat. If you take the projections over the next 40 to 50 years, then that proposition that there will be enough food for everybody is a seriously questionable proposition. We do get to the point where there are more people than there is the food to feed them. And that's where this discussion has been going.
I think another point that's worth noting is that we've looked at existing energy industries and said we don't like them a lot of the time in terms of control of fuel supplies, etc. And there is the possibility of going in a different route in the future, that if you look at distributed energy systems for the future, distributed food systems for the future. And one of the things that we looked at was whether or not we could do this via open source mechanisms. And it seems like a very attractive idea. Generally, people would like to have distributed systems and equal access to food and energy, power. Working out mechanisms to do that is actually quite difficult. The point was raised this morning that we require a lot of input from companies and private investment in order to make things happen. And for open source mechanisms to work, you'd actually need society or governments to invest in those open source mechanisms in order to make them freely available. It's rare that you find companies that will invest in open source. It does happen, but it's, if you're looking at global change, it would require a lot of investment. So one thing that one could look at as a society is how do we make those investments more fairly, and how do we develop systems that are more freely available? But those mechanisms actually need developing.
Take a question over here.
Thanks. Hi. Sam McQueen, you've all talked about genetic techniques of improving production of food and production of energy, or production of power, sorry. I'm just wondering how you sort of see the genetic techniques for achieving those ends sort of mixing with techniques involved in more efficient and effective use of our existing arable land and our existing resources, like how you see those two strategies complementing each other maybe going forward. So, I mean, we use a lot of arable land currently for producing food that is used to feed livestock. In terms of the wine industry, we've had, a wine production glut in Australia for several years, so a lot more land is being used for wine production than is actually necessary. So as the pressure on arable land increases over time, how do you see that being a complementary strategy, I suppose, to tackle these problems?
Would you like to tackle that?
I think that one of the things we need to look at is trying to increase the ability to close production loops. We have a lot of runoff, a lot of waste. The point about peak phosphorus was made earlier on, and it's a valid point, an important point that we need to deal with. And so developing more sustainable systems in which one system runs or connects into another is an important aspect of doing that, recycling. So, for example, with the algal biofuel side of things, one scenario you might look at is that you grow the algae, you harvest the biomass, you could
either extract the oil for biodiesel production or make hydrogen, but the rest of the biomass, you could, if you like to, you could pyrolyze that and make it into biochar, put it back in the soil to increase carbon content. And Australia, for example, has a very low carbon content in much of its soil, and so that would actually be a way of increasing the soil quality in parts of Australia and increase arable land capacity, which perhaps would reduce runoff again, etc., etc. So there's ways of doing that. Economically, right now, probably wouldn't work because we haven't got the legislation in place to do it. And so it's a question, again, of values. Do we want it purely on a dollar value for what you're producing, or do you want to develop a more sustainable future? But I don't think that that is either removing the use of GMOs or non-GMOs. It could be done with either.
And if I can just comment on the wine industry side of things, is it that you're absolutely right, there has been a glut of wine over recent years, and the industry has responded by having large areas of grapevines removed to turn it into other sorts of agriculture. The industry is also very conscious of its environmental footprint and is trying to adopt new methods of irrigation, etc., to minimise its footprint in that regard.
As the current debate about climate change goes on, you can see that we're not very good at making tough decisions. And you're actually calling for some hard decisions to be made. So, for example, there would be crops that you might opt not to grow at all in Australia. But who goes and tells the farmers? So it's very challenging in the type of democracy that we have to make some of these calls.
I'll take the question up the back and then we'll move over to the other side again.
My name's Hamish. I'm an anthropology student here. I'm just sort of picking up on that whole idea of democracy and making the decisions. How do yourselves, the scientists at the forefront of this issue, communicate what you're finding to the people who don't want to make that decision? And Dr. Chambers, you said that Australians are a progressive people and stuff. I think that when it comes to this, you're probably a little bit deluded. Like, I think there's a lot of opposition. And I'm just wondering, is it up to the scientists to communicate this? And if so, how can you do it in a way that's not scientific?
Any of you like to tackle that?
I'll start with that one, yeah. Deluded, possibly. I think scientists have a responsibility to communicate with the public, as we're doing in this venue here, and we have a responsibility to take our discussions, ideas, etc., into the political arena. And there are various ways in which we do that. Many of us will communicate with politicians and with political groups in the community. We communicate through newspapers, magazines, science programs, etc. So I think we try to do that. It can be a little bit tricky, to be honest, because scientists are not trained to do that. So we kind of have to learn it on the run a little bit. Early on in my career, I learned that there would be questions coming up quite often on things like GMs. And I didn't quite know how to deal with that. I think if you go through a humanities background, you have a much better understanding of how to engage in those debates. So maybe one of the things that we should be doing in science, in our science education programs, is teaching students about how to communicate effectively and how to engage in the political arena. And I think that will be more important on into the future. Does that answer your question, or am I still deluded?
There's been three great debates in my lifetime as a scientist, and one of them has been fantastic, and two of them have been diabolical. One that's been fantastic is the stem cell debate, where there has been an openness by politicians to engage and the public to engage and to think about the issues and to reach a national decision. And that has been just a state-of-the-art discussion. The GM discussion, as we're aware of this afternoon, you know, there's been tremendous passion about it. But I think in some senses we've had the wrong debate. We've been talking about, do you want GM or don't you? It's a bit like an evolution debate. Do you believe it or don't you? And nobody walks away from a debate on that topic, you know, having their mind changed. People have preconceived notions. And the better question is, how do you feed the world? Which is a question that we've been trying to address today. And the third area is the climate change debate, which is very the issues are complex, and there are some huge vested interests at play. And we get very confused because we cannot have an unpolluted dialogue on that topic with that as the environment in which it takes place.
Thank you. I'm going to Patrick next.
Thank you. My question is to Paul Chambers, Mr. Chairman. A scientist who's also a winemaker once said to me, yes, of course, genetically modified vines would improve enormously the productivity of Australian wine and probably enhance its quality. We could protect against fungus and so on. But as you said, the Australian wine industry has taken an oath that it will not do this. Mm. But then he went on to say that if the French wine industry was to change its mind and decided it wanted to ensure it's the continuity of its crops, the safety of its vineyard, and improve its quality, if that's possible with the French, then the Australian wine industry would fall like ninepins tomorrow. And indeed, he said that the French, with that exquisite Gallic sense of appropriateness, are already conducting trials, but not in France, but in Bulgaria. Would you like to comment?
Yes. I think if things moved in Europe, I think Australia would follow very quickly. The issue for us is more about export markets and the threat to our export markets. Currently, the regulations in Europe and consumer sentiment in Europe is such that it would be too big a risk for us to go down that path. But I should add that there are many people in the Australian wine industry who would not use GMs, whatever the circumstances. There are many winemakers who are moving more towards biodynamic approaches. It's a very pluralistic industry. There are as many different ways of making wine as there are winemakers out there. So it's not going to be a one-size-fits-all even when we get there. But, yeah, we're watching Europe to see what happens there.
Look, I'm going to close the discussion off there. I'm sorry, we've run out of time, but I'm sure please come up and have a chat to our panel. Could you join me? Thank you very much for that set of questions, but would you join me in thanking our panel?